Okay, well, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about Shiloh. I always like to do that. Most of you know me. Some of you have heard some of this stuff before because I've spoken before, but I did want to kind of do an overview. So I'm Bruce and Tammy's daughter. I've been living in Israel for the past couple of years, working on my PhD there at Ariel University. I've been traveling to Israel for a lot longer than that. I've been doing archaeology in Israel for 15 years now, so it's been a while. And I'm the assistant director of excavations at Tel Shiloh. And I had thought that, you know, you all probably know the history of Shiloh, but I was going to go over it a little bit. And we already had a little bit of an overview, but the fun thing is that you heard different verses than the ones I picked out, mostly. So this works very well together. So we know that Shiloh first shows up in the biblical history when Joshua and the Israelites go and they set up the tabernacle there. And so they assemble there. This actually becomes kind of the capital of Israel for quite a while. So they set up the tabernacle, which makes it the central place of worship. And since basically God is their king, they don't have a human king. Where the tabernacle is and where the high priest is, this is their capital. So they set up the tabernacle, and then this is where they divide up the land from. And then we get into, later on in the Judges, I'm going to read this one. So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. And she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all of the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. So, of course, we know that Hannah gets her son. She names him Samuel, and she fulfills her promise. She brings him back to Shiloh to serve there. And so he's at Shiloh with Eli the high priest, and God appears to him. And so this is God speaking to Samuel and talking about Eli and about Eli's sons. He says, for I have told him, that's Eli, that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. And so they take the Ark of the Covenant out into battle against the Philistines, and which Eli did not like that. And of course we know that the Philistines win the battle, the Ark of the Covenant gets captured. And it says, then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. So the messenger answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. So this is kind of the end of Shiloh being the capital. It has been for 300 plus years, probably around 320 years. This has been the capital of Israel, and it never is again. The Ark never comes back to Shiloh. The tabernacle itself is moved. We see it later on moving around a little bit from place to place, but it finally ends up in Jerusalem. David brings the Ark of the Covenant finally to Jerusalem, and that becomes the new capital of Israel. But this is really the end of Shiloh as we know it. And in this portion, in the narrative here, we don't read anything about Shiloh itself being destroyed. We know that the Philistines won the battle, but that's a ways away. It's actually the messenger that came, the Benjaminite, he ran a marathon that day. That's the distance from the battlefield to Shiloh. But we know archaeologically that Shiloh was destroyed at this point, and we get hints of it in the Bible. So we read in Psalms, yet they tested and provoked the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, for they provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent he had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hands. And then in Jeremiah, this is God speaking through Jeremiah and predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. So he's contrasting it with what happened at Shiloh. He says, but go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. Therefore I will do to the house which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place, he's talking about Jerusalem, which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. So we get these hints that Shiloh was destroyed. We see it archaeologically. And so we have a pretty good, you know, case that, that yes, Shiloh was actually destroyed at this point. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of an idea of where Shiloh is. We have ancient trade routes that run through the land of Israel. So to get your bearing, of course, we have the Mediterranean Sea, Sea of Galilee up north, and just the top of the Dead Sea visible there. And so these are the ancient trade routes, the yellow line, or orange, or whatever it shows up as. This is called the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea. So this was a major trade route that followed kind of the coastline there. And then the green line, that goes up the Jordan Rift Valley, because that's a nice level place to travel. So that's called the Jordan Rift Valley route. And then this purple line that goes up the center, this map isn't quite topographical, so maybe you don't know, but from the sea, the land goes up, up, up to a central ridge, and then down, 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 because the Jordan Rift Valley is actually quite a bit below sea level. So you have this mountain range that runs the whole length of Israel. And so this trade route follows that ridge, and that's called the Way of the Patriarchs. So when you read about Abraham going up and down, he goes up to Shechem, he goes down past Jerusalem, he goes down, and Abraham moves up and down and up and down, and Jacob also, you see him moving up and down this route. So that's called the Way of the Patriarchs. And so that goes right past Shiloh. So Shiloh's kind of in the middle there. So that's where it's located. And it's a really nice location. So here you can see the Tel Shiloh. The Tel is a word for ancient mound of ruins. It's actually on a natural hill, but it's also a tell at the same time. And it's iconic. They put this visitor center that I think looks like a spaceship on the top. So when you see that, you know it's Shiloh. But this is in a really nice wide valley that's really good for agriculture. And there's a spring nearby. So Shiloh's really a prime place to live. The Israelites did well to choose it because this was a good place, and they would grow vineyards and grains there, all kinds of things, olive trees that you can grow in that area. In the past, there have been excavations at Shiloh. It's a big site, so each team has excavated little portions of it, but for over 100 years, there have been excavations on and off at Shiloh. Last year, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of excavations. It was a Danish team that started excavating at Shiloh in 1922. So last year, we celebrated the 100th anniversary, and the fun thing is that we have a group of Danish people that come dig with our team. And so they were pretty pleased that they were there digging at Shiloh 100 years after their own group started digging there. And then in the 1980s, there was a big excavation there by Israel Finkelstein. And I refer to his work a lot. Actually, he and I are interested in a lot of the same things, so I'm always reading his work. We come to very different conclusions, though. So it's always fun to read his data and see the things that he found and then figure out, you know, how he got to his conclusions and whether or not those are really good. He has a very anti-biblical bias, and I have a biblical bias. And so I'm always interacting with his work, but his publication on Shiloh is actually quite excellent, at least in the data that he published. And so it's really helpful to refer to that when we're digging at Shiloh. And then Kamat has done some excavations at Shiloh, and Kamat is the branch of the Israeli government that is in charge of archaeological excavations in that region. And so when we dig, we have to get a permit from Kamat. That's the way it works, but they also have their own archaeologists on staff, and so they've done some work at Shiloh, not so much on the Tell itself, which is in the center, but to the north and to the south, they've done a lot of excavations. So when we came in, we kind of knew what to expect because enough work had been done. Again, it's a big site. There's still a lot that's not excavated, but we kind of knew what had happened there, what had been found. And so I'm part of the ABR excavation at Shiloh. It stands for Associates for Biblical Research. Like I said, I'm the assistant director of this team. We've been digging there since 2017. We dig for a month each summer, and that gives us enough data to spend the rest of the year researching and processing it. And it's one of the largest dig teams in Israel. It's made up of volunteers. Any of you can come and dig at Shiloh if you want to. And so last year we had 220 people who signed up and came. This year, we were headed toward being an even bigger team. The war has set us back. We're not even sure if we're going to be able to dig. We hope so. But this is a very popular thing because we're one of the few teams of evangelical Christians digging in Israel. So if somebody is interested in biblical history and wants to go dig, they can sign up for other digs as well. But there's a solidarity to where we get a lot of Christians coming from America to come and dig with us. So we've had 5 dig seasons. We lost a couple years due to COVID, but we've had 5 complete dig seasons now. And when we dig, we're looking at stratigraphy. So at the surface, this is a cross-section, so it's a cut, and this is one of the areas that we've excavated, so this is actually real stuff that we've found. So on the surface, when you think about it, we might find the coins that some tourist dropped out of their pocket. It's the newest things are on the top. And then as you go down, you get to older and older and older things. Because the way it works is when they build a city, they build it up, and then when it's destroyed, there's stone walls that get pushed over, there's wood roofs that get burned, and so it leaves this layer of debris. And they don't clear it down and start over, they just kind of level it and build on top. So it builds up, up, up. So down at the bottom, the yellow stuff, that's the earliest, that's the Bronze Age. The green is Iron Age stuff that we're finding, blue is Roman period, and then purple is Byzantine and even more recent. And so we have all of these time periods of history at Shiloh, and I'm going to go through them a little bit and explain to you what they are and how they relate to biblical history. So Shiloh was actually founded before the Israelites arrived there. It doesn't show up in biblical history before that because it's not relevant to what the Bible's talking about. But archaeologically, we know that it was founded in the Middle Bronze Age, around 1650 BC. And this is while the Israelites are slaves in Egypt, probably. So they're off in Egypt. There's Canaanites living here. They build the city. They fortify it. It has this massive fortification wall that encircles the entire city. What's pictured here on the left is what we're hoping is the city gate. We've been excavating here. We found a gap in the wall. At first, we thought that it's just a place where the wall was broken, but it seems very symmetrical. There's some large building protruding out that's probably a gate tower. This year, we uncovered a row of columns within that, which is really nice. So we're very hopeful that we have the city gate. Archaeologists like gates because that's where everything happens. This is where administrative things happen. If you remember the story of Ruth and Boaz, Boaz goes to the city gate to talk to the elders and his relative about Ruth. This is where, at least in pagan cities, this is where worship happens because you set up a shrine in the gate. This is where trade happens because you let traders come as far as your gate and set up a booth there, but you don't let them into your city. So trade happens in the gate. And then, of course, in times of war, this is your main security for the city because you close all the gates and you have the towers that you can shoot down from. So the gate is really important. We're really hopeful that we have it here. We've also found storerooms from this period. And this is a jar I put together last winter with a small team. We put it all back together. That was a fun puzzle. But we actually put together 3 of them. All the pieces, of course, were all mixed up, and we had to figure out which pieces belonged with which jar. And it's quite large. It's probably like this tall. So that's the Middle Bronze Age. That's when Shiloh was founded. And then moving on, we get to the Iron Age. And this is when the Israelites are living at Shiloh. This is a little model house, actually. So the Israelites lived in what they called a 4-room house. This was a style that they liked to build. There would be 3 parallel rooms, long rooms parallel, and then 1 across the back. So when we find one of these houses, we're like, oh, this is probably Israelite here. So we find these at Shiloh, and it was actually quite nice that the Kamat team excavated a 4-room house, and then they built this little model of it right next to it so you can see how it works. But I was walking by at sunset, and I snapped that picture because I liked it. So we see the Israelites living at Shiloh, both during the time that the tabernacle is there, and then a little bit actually after that. So they probably came back in. It wasn't a huge city. It wasn't a capital. It wasn't a center of worship, but there were still Israelites living there for a while after that. And then we get to New Testament times, the Roman period, and it's a city then. The New Testament doesn't talk about it. We don't read about Jesus coming to Shiloh. He may have. It may just not have been important enough to make it in. But we have quite a large settlement here, and more than one phase. I was looking at the walls, and I color-coded them because I noticed that they were at different angles. And then when we look on our cross-section, which I showed you before, it turns out that they're actually at different levels as well. So we have more than one phase from this same period where they built some houses, probably the orange ones first, and then they rebuilt, probably kind of crashed those and rebuilt this bigger house that I have in the blue, which is really quite large. This is a Herodian-style oil lamp. I actually found that myself, which is pretty rare because I hardly ever get to dig anymore, too busy doing paperwork. But for some reason, one day I was digging and that popped out, and that's very nice. We don't find complete things very often, so I was excited about that. But that, if when Jesus talks about oil lamps, that's what he's talking about. This is the style from that day. We use a metal detector while we're digging. We're not treasure hunting. We're not digging for treasure, but as we're excavating, we scan to make sure that we don't miss things. And so we find a lot of coins. This coin is the most common type that we find. It's called a Hasmonean strap coin. And it's hard to tell, but on that upper one, you can see it's stamped off center. It's not stamped very nicely, but it has a star on it. And that's the Messianic star. They were hoping for the Messiah, and so they were putting his star on their coins. And the way these were formed is they had a strip mold, and so a strip with little bubbles all the way down, and they would pour the metal, and then they would chop it. And so that's why you get the flange on each end of the coin. So these are, like, easy to spot. You see that, and you know what it is. You know it's a Hasmonean strap coin. And it's very low value, especially at this period, because when they were first made was during the Hasmonean period, but they continued in circulation for over 100 years. And so by the time of Jesus, these things were the cheapest of pocket change. These were the pennies. And this is probably the widow's mite. We read in Mark, "Now Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money in the treasury, and many who were rich put in much. And then one poor widow came and threw in two mites, which make a quadrant. And he called to his disciples to himself and said to them, 'Assuredly, I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury, for they all put in out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had, her whole livelihood.'" And so that's probably what those coins are, is the widow's mite. And then moving on through history, we get to the Byzantine period. This is after the New Testament. And this is the period when tourism in Israel started, because Christianity had spread throughout the Roman Empire, and Christians wanted to come to Israel and see where everything happened. And so we have churches, Byzantine churches, where they would go to every holy site and build a church to commemorate it so tourists could come. And so there are actually multiple Byzantine churches at Shiloh, probably commemorating ancient Shiloh. And most of them are to the south of the Tell. We work on the north side. But this season, this summer, we started a new square in an area we hadn't worked before, and we found a Byzantine. It's probably a house. I don't know. It's got a funny curved wall, which is unusual. We only did one square there. We'll have to do more next year and see what we find. It had a nice mosaic floor. You can see chunks of the mosaics, and they found a bunch of loose ones. So they were collecting those because this is very common of the Byzantine period. You have these mosaic floors. So we do have that period, again, period of tourism at Israel, in Israel and at Shiloh. And then moving on, we get to the Islamic period. And this was quite a long period in the history of Israel. And what they did is they took these churches and they turned them into mosques. So the building in the background here is a mosque. It's probably about 1,000 years old, but it's built on the foundation of a Byzantine church. And then we have modern Shiloh. And so you can see in the foreground one of our girls working in our excavation area, but on the background you see houses on the hills, and up on that high hill is actually where they have their synagogue. This is a Jewish settlement, modern Shiloh, and so Shiloh continues to be inhabited to this day. It just moved a hill over. And actually, the people of Shiloh are very proud that they have an ancient site in their backyard. They run a gift shop, and they keep the site beautiful. They take good care of it. So some of the things we find, because I know you guys want pictures of cool things. These are actually all from the last couple years, I think. So starting on the left, this is a coin. This is actually from the Bar Kokhba revolt, around 125, I think. No, 135 AD. So this is, there were several Jewish revolts against Rome, all of which failed. The Bar Kokhba revolt was kind of a second attempt. And so they minted these coins that were very, very patriotic. I think the other side of this coin actually has the temple on it. And this side has, the inscription is something about for Jerusalem, I think. I could be wrong on that. But very patriotic coins, stirring the Jewish spirit, trying to get the Jews to revolt against Rome. And then down below, this is a scarab. We like finding scarabs. These are seals. They're shaped like a beetle. The word scarab means beetle, and on the flip side of it, it's rounded, and it's got like the little head and wings carved. And then on the belly of the beetle is a design. And sometimes these have a name on them. These are Egyptian style, although some of them are made in Canaan. This one doesn't have a name on it. It's just got designs. But this is somebody's seal, where he would stamp it into clay or something to seal a letter or something like that. So we always like to find these. They're easier to date, and so they help us a lot. Above that, it's a little hard to see what that is, but it's a clay cylinder. It's got a hole through the middle, so it can be a bead. And these kind of things often have designs on them where you roll it across clay, and it makes a picture. This one has just a bunch of little marks. It doesn't seem to have a picture. So we're doing some research on it. I've been talking to a guy who can do 3D scanning, and he can actually like make a 3D picture unrolled so that we can see what it looks like flat. It might have cuneiform writing on it, which is the ancient type where they write with little wedges and it looks like a bunch of little lines. So that would be fun if it says something that we can translate. We don't know yet. And then in the middle, this little guy, I think he's really cute or really ugly, I'm not sure which. But he's a little idol that we found. He probably dates to the Canaanite period before the Israelites were at Shiloh, although it wouldn't surprise me if the Israelites had idols. We read about that a lot in the Bible. But this guy's probably from before that, and I think he's a cow. I'm not sure. He has a really long face. He has something up on his head. It might be a horn, but it's broken off, so we're doing research on that. Not quite sure what that is yet. And then going on the top there, that's a carnelian bead. Carnelian is a reddish stone, and that it was very, very popular. So somebody had nice jewelry. Below that is an arrowhead, a bronze arrowhead. So that was used in some battle at Shiloh, probably. And then on the end is a gold star. We don't find a lot of gold. Archaeologists in general don't find a lot of gold, but I'll talk actually more about that later, so I'll leave that to talk about. So, of course, when archaeologists come to Shiloh, what we want to figure out is where was the tabernacle? Like, this is the big question. This is the thing that Shiloh is famous for, is having the tabernacle. So there have been a lot of ideas about where the tabernacle at Shiloh might be, and here are some of the ideas that have been proposed in the past. Some people, and actually if you go on a tour of Israel and you go to Shiloh, your tour guide will probably tell you that it was to the north. There's a flat area, a big platform there that would easily fit the tabernacle. And that is, like I said, the most accepted location. There's not really any evidence for it being there. There are some cup holes cut in the ground that they say are for the posts for the tabernacle. I've seen those kind of cup holes at a lot of sites, though, so I don't know that that's particularly good evidence. It could be. There's room for it there. It's flat. It's nice. Like, it could be. One problem that I have with that is that it's outside of the city and doesn't seem like a very secure location. And then some people have suggested that it's on the south, down here, and that's because that's where all the Byzantine churches are, and the Byzantines tried to build their churches on the exact spot where things happened. So they say, well, the Byzantines commemorated this place, therefore maybe this is where the tabernacle was. And again, there's room for it there. It could fit. I don't think there's any evidence beyond that the Byzantine churches were there. And sometimes the Byzantine people did have traditions that carried through, and so sometimes they got things right, and sometimes they got things wrong. So we don't know. And then some people say that it should be on the summit, on the very top, because that's where ancient people put their religious places. You read about the high places in Jerusalem. They put the temple on the hill up above the city. So that's actually pretty logical. We actually measured it out. We were like, is there room for it up here? And yes, there is. So those are kind of the three main theories about where the tabernacle may have been. But the problem is that nobody's been able to really prove any of them. So when we started digging, this is our excavation area in the blue here, and we just kind of got assigned this area. It was an area that hadn't been excavated yet. It looked like it might be interesting, and so we started digging there, and we found what we're calling a monumental building, and that's what it is. It's a very large building, too big to be a private home. This is some kind of public building. And here's what we think the layout is going to look like. We've uncovered some of the walls. The solid lines are walls that we have uncovered. The dotted lines are what we're projecting should be there. Again, you never know. But we did find this corner down here, so we do know that there's a wall shooting across on the south there. And so what we have is a building that's long and narrow. It runs east-west. It's divided into two rooms, at least. And it's a one-third, two-third division. And this is very reminiscent of the layout of the tabernacle and or the temple, where you have the holy place and then the holy of holies. It's lined up the right way, the way it's supposed to sit. And size-wise, it's a little bigger than the tabernacle, a little smaller than the Jerusalem temple. So it's kind of right in there. So we were uncovering this, and we're like getting excited, and like, could it be? Like, no, it couldn't be. Could it be? And so we've been working on this for since 2017 when we started excavating at the site. But I want to show you some of the things that we found, like in and around this building. So one thing that we found is a ceramic pomegranate, and we know that the pomegranate is a motif of Israelite worship. The high priest had bells and pomegranates hanging from his robe. Solomon decorated the temple in Jerusalem with pomegranates. This one has a nice hole in the top so that you could hang it. And so to us, that's a sign that we're finding evidence of Jewish religion here at Shiloh. So that was pretty cool. That was found right next to the monumental building. And then we found this stone that has a protrusion on top. And we know what this is because we've seen them from other sites. This is an altar horn. I don't know if you remember reading in the Old Testament about altars having horns. That's what it is. They had protrusions on each of the four corners. And so we find this, it's not big enough to be like the big altar for sacrifice, like in front of the tabernacle. It's smaller, maybe for an incense altar or something like that. But again, we're starting to see evidence of sacrifice, of religion here at Shiloh. And then this year, we found this. This is a murex shell, and this is the kind of shell that they use to make the purple dye. And the purple dye is very important. It's a very expensive dye, and it's used in making the hangings for the tabernacle, the priestly garments, all of this. They needed murex dye for that. And so we were pretty excited. I mean, of course, one shell doesn't mean that we have murex production, but we also found pieces of a jar, and the inside was stained purple. And we need to do, again, we don't want to jump to conclusions. We need to do residue analysis and find out what stained that jar purple. But finding that along with this shell got us thinking, okay, you know, maybe we got to keep digging. We got to find more. But that's pretty exciting for us to have a murex there. And then if you go out what we think is the front door of the monumental building and go to the edge of the site, there's a bone deposit there. And this was actually first excavated by Israel Finkelstein in the 1980s. He reported on it. And we've been doing some more work there. And we find thousands and thousands of bones. And these are all sheep and goats and cows. They're all young animals. And there are more bones from the right side than the left side of the animal. If you remember, this is a pretty insignificant detail, so don't feel bad if you don't. But the right side of the animal is the priestly portion. And so these are all, like I said, all sacrificial animal bones, just thousands and thousands of them, in what we would call a favisa, which is a sacred deposit. Basically, you have trash, but it's sacred trash, so you can't just throw it away, so you bury it, and you make a burial of it. And then in with those bones, we find beautiful pottery, painted ware here. This is a chalice over there, just very nice pottery, nicer than what we find anywhere else on the site. And so we think that these were offerings. And when you bring an offering, you bring grain in a bowl or something, and then you break the bowl because you don't want to keep it. It's been offered, but like the priest really doesn't need hundreds and thousands of bowls. And so it goes in the favisa. And then we have gold. And like I said, gold is very rare. Archaeologists seldom find gold. I know many archaeologists who have never found gold, even though they've been digging for decades. And we've found, I think now we're up to 5 pieces of gold out of this one bone deposit. We have 2 really pretty stars, and then this little spoon-shaped pendant, and a couple other pieces that are broken. But this is really significant, because when you find gold in archaeological sites, it's either in a destruction layer where everybody had to run and everybody got killed and nobody could come back for their gold, or it's in religious deposits where they were offerings. This is not a destruction layer. This is a religious deposit of offerings. And so it's really significant. It also ties to Mount Ebal, where Joshua built an altar there. And again, there they found gold in offerings. And so that's a parallel with the with those two sites. And so we're getting, you know, more and more convinced that there's something significant going on here. There's definitely religious practices happening here. It seems to be Israelite religious. And I mean, when you put that together with the fact that we know that Shiloh is where the tabernacle was, you know, we're getting into some pretty significant clues here. But then the question is, we've got a building, it's got stone walls, but the tabernacle was a tent. So, like, should we even be looking for a stone building? I think that there are some clues that they did build a permanent structure at Shiloh. We read in 1 Samuel, it says, before the lamp of God had gone out, Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was located. Samuel lay down until the morning, and then he opened the doors of the Lord's house. These are all words of a permanent building. And I actually specifically chose this version, the CSB, because it uses the word temple there. Some versions actually put tabernacle. And that's because the translators knew that the tabernacle was at Shiloh, not the temple. But when you actually look at the Hebrew word, it is a different word there. It's a word of a permanent structure as opposed to the tent. And so that's why I chose this translation. But we see that this is words belonging to a permanent structure when Samuel is there. And then there's Jewish Mishnaic writings, and these are written a lot later, so we don't know if they, you know, knew what they were talking about, but they may have had some tradition that went back. It says Shiloh's sanctuary had stone walls covered by tapestries, and the other one says there was no roof beam there, but below was a house of stone, and above were hangings, and this was the resting place. So again, these are clues that, yes, maybe there was an actual stone building that they built there, a temple of sorts, but that they left the tent over the top. So it was kind of still the tabernacle, but kind of also a permanent structure. So we're kind of working through these ideas to figure out what to expect. So the question is, have we found the tabernacle at Shiloh? And I would love to say yes. At this point, I'm still saying maybe. We got to keep digging. We got to get down to the floor level, because what we find on the floor there will tell us a lot more. This summer we actually got down to the floor in one, we did a probe. We went down in one little spot. We found the floor. We know it's there. We know how far we have to dig to find it. But we're really hoping that we find good evidence there. We've narrowed down the time frame. We know that this building is from the time of the Israelites being there at Shiloh. And so we're pretty excited to see what else we find. Hopefully we get to dig this summer. With the war going on, I'm not sure, but we're pretty excited. So that's what I've got for you. Don't know if we want to do questions or...
Any
Sure.
So the picture of the lamp, is that the type of lamp that the parable where Jesus said that the 10 virgins had their lamps and five were...
Yes.
Is that what they would have had?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so little lamps, and then you find little jars. They're called filler jars. So you bring your extra oil. So you fill up your lamp with oil, but it doesn't hold very much. So you bring a filler jar to refill it. And so, yes, the five wise virgins brought their filler jar, and the five foolish virgins did not. The lamp? I could hold it in the palm of my hand. It's quite small. Yeah. Yes?
I remember studying a bit of Diggs 70 years ago. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the nations that were there, they took a lot of the relics back to their nations. Are there restrictions for everything to stay in Israel at this point?
Yes, everything that we find belongs to the Israeli government. Sometimes we're allowed to borrow things from them. We can take them out for research. Sometimes we can take them to get testing done, like I was talking about. We want to get the residue analysis done. We just got carbon-14 dating done on some of those bones from the bone deposit, so we're waiting to get results on that. We actually, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but we got some really exciting carbon-14 dates from a destruction layer where we didn't think that there had been a destruction. So I probably shouldn't give more details on that right now because it's not published, but we archaeologists like destruction layers. Those are good.
So this Israel had access to those relics that were removed from the country? Is there a chance they would ever take them back?
I don't know if they take them back. Yeah, because the rules have changed. So for my research for my PhD, I'm going to have to go and track things down, and I'm already making a list, okay, the University of Toronto has stuff I need to look at. And I was in Denmark a couple months ago, and I went to the museum there, and I was able to, because the Danish dug at Shiloh, I was able to look at the things that the Danish had dug up at Shiloh, which I'd never been able to see before. But I had to go to Denmark for that.
Are there things in the U.S.?
I believe so. Some at universities, possibly even some in private collections. It can be a trick to track things down. Yeah.
Any swords or
arrows? Yeah.
Swords or shields, anything like that?
No swords. We did find a nice spear point and an axe head. Bronze and even iron, you don't find a whole lot of it, especially the larger things, because it was valuable, so it was remelted down a lot. But yeah, we do find a lot of arrowheads. Those are small and easy to lose. And every now and then something bigger, but not a lot.
Are those stone arrowheads?
We don't find a lot of stone arrowheads. We find flint blades, like sickle blades, from the earlier periods, and every now and then a flint arrowhead, but mostly we find metal.
Flint arrowhead, that's pretty unique, right? Because that's pretty common in this part of the country.
Yeah, they had them there as well. There are areas where in Israel where flint occurs naturally, and so they knew where to go and get flint, and they would make them into tools and blades and things and arrowheads.
Yeah. Okay, so you leave for a year or whatever time it is. Is that site set aside for your team only, or can other people come in?
So because we have an excavation permit, we're kind of the ones working there. Now, Kamat is the government branch. They have an archaeologist who actually, she lives in modern Shiloh, and she is the archaeologist in charge of the Kamat excavations. And she works off and on, but never in our little portion of the site. She works in other areas. And she'll communicate with us. So recently, actually, flint blades. She said, I'm going to write an article about the flint blades that I found. Can I include the ones you found? And so one of our team members is co-authoring this with her. So we work together with her, and it works out really well.
I want to go back to the, was that a seashell, actually, like a conch?
The murex, yeah. Yeah, it's a seashell. And so you find factories for this purple dye, you find them a lot on the coast. There's one at Tel Dor, and I think one at Ashdod. So these sites on the coast where they had access to them, that's often where you find those factories. But finding the shells so far inland is really unusual.
Yeah, I was about to say, so that is used as a tool for making dots?
No, so, okay, so there's actually something in the shell itself. I'm not sure if it's in the shell or in the animal in the shell. I think it's actually the animal.
It's like a snail or something.
Yeah, there's a snail that lives in it, and it, I guess if you boil it, it makes blue or purple dye. And so I don't know how they figured that out. Sometimes you wonder, like, who thought, I think I'll boil the snail and see what happens. But somebody figured that out. And
so how far back does that go, that particular shell itself? Because that's an absolutely pretty good shape.
Yeah, I mean, the context it was in and everything, It was in a washed context where dirt had washed down the hill, so it's hard to tell. But it could easily go back to the time of the Israelites being there. Again, we need to hopefully dig more and find more in a more secure context. But the jar that's stained inside, that was in a very clear context, late Bronze Age, which is when the Israelites first arrived in Canaan. So if the shell goes with that jar, then that helps solidify the date for it.
How big is the site?
Shiloh, I should memorize how big it is in acres. I would say a couple few acres. It's not very big. I can walk across it probably in 10 minutes. But for an ancient city, it's actually decent sized because ancient cities weren't all that big. We don't even know for sure if a lot of people lived in ancient cities. They may have been more administrative centers where everybody lived out in the farm area. And then if your enemy comes, of course, everybody runs into the city. At least that's kind of the way I picture it, because these cities were pretty small.
What about like hieroglyphics or any kind of ancient or writings on the walls, you might say, any of that?
We're always looking for inscriptions. Yes. It's actually funny. I gave a presentation in Israel, and there's this old guy in the audience, and he raised his hand. He was like, I was the epigrapher for Israel Finkelstein's dig in the 1980s. He was like, and Israel never found anything for me. He was like, have you guys found anything for me? And I was like, no, sorry. We're trying, but no, nothing to read. Yeah, it's actually pretty rare. And on the later things, you know, we find like coins with inscriptions on them. Those are from the later periods. And sometimes, so the scarabs, those are earlier. And sometimes we find them with like a pharaoh's name on it or something. And there was one piece found, not by us, by an earlier excavation that had an inscription, but it was broken to where you couldn't, like the message was missing. So, yeah, it's pretty rare to find inscriptions.
Where you're in the West Bank, mm-hmm. doing most of what you do, do you have sites disturbed by Muslims, damaging things?
Yeah, Shiloh is very secure because it's right next to that Jewish village. The whole site is fenced, so that's very secure. We go away and come back, and it's exactly the way we left it. Where we dug before that at Kerbet el-Makadr, it was right next to a Palestinian village. And we would go away and come back the next day, and somebody had been digging there. And eventually what we did is we hired the local teenagers to guard the site, which I think we were hiring them not to loot the site. One way or another, we gave them money, and they left it alone. So, yeah. Yeah, but that site, since we stopped digging there in 2016, and it's very destroyed. I went back actually this summer. And they've filled in our excavation areas with trash, they've looted, they've dug holes, they've broken down walls. They think we're looking for gold, so they think there must be gold there if we're looking for it, and so they look for it. Yeah.
So how far are you away from your dissertation, your doctorate? Is that gateway for publications?
Yeah, I have 2 more years left for my dissertation process. I can actually publish now. I usually co-author with someone who already has a PhD, but yeah, I can publish. but it'll give me more credibility to have the PhD. So, two more years. Plus, I can get my own dig permit if I want to dig somewhere.
Your name will be first on your permit.
Right.
Do you have a dream of digging in some particular place?
Not specifically. I've got ideas, but right now I'm happy with the ABR team and working with them. I think that's a good fit for me.
And do you mind not digging so much as doing paperwork?
I prefer digging. That's the fun part. But I know the paperwork needs to be done, and so I do that. And I do enjoy research, because research is a little bit of digging in and of itself. You have to dig through all of the past publications and find things. So.
Kind of nice, too, to have gained enough expertise to disagree with
someone. Right.
Agree or disagree, to have an opinion.
Yeah. I try not to pick fights with other researchers, but I'm allowed to disagree, yeah.
Can you say anything about that disagreement that you have?
Oh, Israel Finkelstein. So he is what's called a biblical minimalist, which means that he believes that the Bible is minimally accurate as a historical text. I'm a maximalist, on the other hand. And so we look at the same data and just come to very different conclusions because we both come at it with preconceived ideas. Like, the idea of research is that you're supposed to be unbiased, but you can't be. You can't. No one person can do so much research that they have researched everything. They have to accept the work of previous researchers. They have to come at it with some ideas preconceived that they just like settle with. Okay, I believe this is true, and therefore I'm going to build on that. And so we just come at it from very different ideas. He thinks that the Israelites were not in the land as early as I think that they were. So if he finds something, he's going to say, obviously, this isn't Israelite because the Israelites weren't there. If I find something, I'm going to say, maybe this is Israelite because the Israelites were there. And so it's just kind of this back and forth of, coming at it from different ideas and therefore coming to different conclusions. But I can look at his research, his raw data, and it's good. And I can use that because he's a good archaeologist. It's just one of those things. It's like I hardly ever agree with him on anything, but I interact with his work a lot.
Is he a Jew?
Yes.
I thought he was.
Yes, he is.
Is that like a museum on top? Is there
artifacts
and such
in that? Yeah, so downstairs they have a little museum, and then upstairs they have like a video that you can watch in there. So, that's what that is.
So what were the findings that they have, even though they stay within the Israelite government, do they display those in the museum themselves as artifacts?
Not necessarily. Like most everything we've found just sits in boxes in a storehouse. So there is the Israel Museum in Jerusalem where like they display the best of the best.
Yeah.
But because we dig in the West Bank and it's a little contested, they usually won't put stuff from that in the museum just because they don't want to cause a ruckus. So our stuff is less likely to get displayed than from other areas.
Yeah, they kind of talk about 1,000 molds and they all
boxed. Yeah.
So when you're digging to the different layers, your time periods, your judges are based on commonality of items, right?
Yeah, so pottery is what we find the most of, broken pottery. And archaeologists have actually built this typology because pottery changes over time. So like if you think about your grandma's dishes, her fine china, versus maybe the Corel that you have in your kitchen, whatever, it's a little different, and you can see the differences. And so over the thousands of years, pottery styles changed. And so that's what we do every day. We read pottery. We look at the pottery we dug up, and we say, okay, this is from this time period, this is from this time period. And we see, oh, we're getting the older pottery now, so we've switched to an earlier layer. Pottery is the main thing. And then other things that help, like coins and scarabs, those help us to confirm the dating to make sure that we're not messing something up.
Based on that, do you
very often find items in a different layer that kind of don't belong to the predate the layer you're currently in?
Yeah, we do find things mixed up. Sometimes it's because there's a fill, like some farmer just brought in nice dirt and put it there, and then that stuff's all mixed up. Sometimes there's rodents that will push things into the wrong layer. So we find like rodent holes and then pottery next to it, and it's like, yeah, no, that doesn't belong there. But for the most part, we try to be careful so that we don't accidentally mix things up. And so we separate pottery frequently. Like, we just don't keep digging and putting it all together. We dig in shallow layers and separate it so that we're not mixing things up. And then sometimes if it's like, okay, we have, 100 pieces that are all the same, and then there's this one that doesn't belong, it's like, okay, something happened, a mouse put it there, we're not going to throw out the whole batch, because of that. But when it's very, very mixed, then we're like, okay, this has been disturbed, this has been mixed up, this isn't a clean context. So part of it is just like learning how to assess it and figure out what's going on.
Any idea when you will return to Israel?
I don't know yet. I'm kind of working on it. I think I'm going to stick around for a little while here because I can work on my PhD from here. So I'll see how things go with the war. I've got to get my visa renewed. I've got to get a plane ticket. So I think I'm just not going to be in too much of a hurry right now. And yeah, I'll just see what happens.
In fact, where the situation Israel is, how close is this to the conflict?
It's not close at all. So most of what's going on is down in Gaza, which is way in the south. They do shoot rockets toward Jerusalem sometimes, but this is way north. So anything in this region that would be going on would be, because it's in the West Bank, and so there are Palestinians and Jewish people living side by side, there could be like some Palestinian who's like, ooh, this is the time to fight, and goes off and, does something, but that would be isolated incidents. So Shiloh is actually still like quite safe at the moment. Done? Okay. Oh, I'll show you one more thing. I added this just like kind of at the last minute. I don't know if you all are aware of the curse tablet from Mount Ebal. Our team found this. We did a sifting project, and so it's this lead tablet, and there's this inscription that's all these curses. You're cursed by the God Yahweh. Cursed, you will die. Cursed, you will surely die. Cursed by Yahweh. And so we think that this correlates with the ceremony that Joshua had at Mount Ebal, where Mount Ebal was the mountain of the curse. Mount Gerizim was the mountain of the blessing, and basically they're promising God, if we obey you, we get blessed. If we disobey you, we get cursed. And so recently I got this picture sent to me. This is the Jewish military rockets in response to Hamas. These are what they're shooting at back at Hamas. And they're writing the curse on the rockets. So there you go. Finish with that.
Abigail, thank you. We've been looking forward to that.